From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Professor Darnell Hunt of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA examines images and hiring practices in the movie and film industries in his 2015 Hollywood Diversity Report. And we're joined by a distinguished panel of scholars to mark the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War and its impact into the 21st century. But first, environmental activist Aaron Brockovich is troubled by recently introduced Senate legislation that would allow manufacturers to sell chemical products without proving their safety. Brockovich, whose work became known worldwide after she was portrayed by Julia Roberts in the film that bears her name, joins me now with the details of her latest crusade for environmental justice. Aaron, good to see you.
It's good to see you. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Tell me about this bill.
Okay, the Toxic Substance Control Act was established back in 1976. It's one that's supposed to have reform and oversee the 84,000 chemicals that flood our market every single year. Mm-hmm. The last time it had some reform was in 1996, and that was for pesticides. Mm-hmm. And we are back now, again, reforming this bill, and it's been really 30 years since any reform has been done. And the bill that was introduced by Vitter and Udall for toxic substance is supposed to be where the parties are coming together, but we don't see the bill that way at all. Mm-hmm. There's changes in this new bill that make the current law for TSCA worse. They've set no deadlines for the EPA to review chemicals. The EPA says currently there's 1,000 top priority chemicals that need to be reviewed before they even hit the market. Mm-hmm. Each chemical takes a review process of 7 years or longer. Normally what happens is while the EPA is reviewing these chemicals, the states can come in and set standards and act until the EPA has set a standard in order to protect their citizens. Mm-hmm. What they're asking for in this bill is this preemption comes on the front. So when a chemical goes under review, if it's preempted right at the get-go, all the states and the attorney generals are preempted. Their hands are tied, mm-hmm. and they have no ability to act on behalf of their citizens, their environment, as a state in protecting them. That is the biggest change in the bill that disturbs me mm-hmm. the most, because 41 states are doing really fabulous work as we wait for the EPA to study these chemicals mm-hmm. in protecting its citizens and setting standards. California is a perfect example. The EPA has still not established or done its reviews or studies for hexavalent chromium in drinking water. So the state of California has stepped up and done that. They have been the first state to set a standard for hexavalent chromium in drinking water to protect the citizens of the state of California. With this new TSCA reform bill, the way it's written mm-hmm. under the Udall-Vitter side, would no longer allow after the 1st of January 2015 mm-hmm. for states to now act. That is craziness. You were talking about, I don't know what's going on up on the Hill, but all these Republican bills coming in that want preemption, that will block states' right, drives me mad, because you protest all the time. You don't want bigger government. Mm-hmm. Yet that's exactly what you're doing. You're taking away the rights of the states, their ability to act, the attorney general's ability to act, and you're creating a larger federal government.
Why are states being punished? Why are they being preempted? Why are their hands being tied? Yeah, I'm not stupid. Yeah, I know somebody's behind this, but why is the federal government, at least if these two senators have their way, Udall and Vitter, why are they doing this?
That's a really good question. And without really delving into their minds and understanding it, I could tell you at first blush, it reminds me of the toy companies. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is when something comes in and floods the market and we don't really know its safety, they have to deal with the big companies, if mm-hmm. you will, that the states have ability to sue and to protect its citizen. And by coming in and having a federal standard that's lower,
sure,
allows them to come in. And now if they can get rid of the states, they don't have to deal with those lawsuits, those issues.
Who is the they? Somebody's winning here. Who's winning?
I would believe me, for me.
Yeah.
Again, without really delving into this, behind it would have to be big industry.
Sure. That's the answer.
That's what I believe.
Yeah.
Because it makes no sense. Mm-hmm. You know, and so in this TSCA reform bill, it sets no deadline. It ties up the state's rights to act, which I just think is, it's 2015. This mm-hmm. is just craziness. When 41 states are doing phenomenal work in establishing standards and helping protect their citizens, and it doesn't provide any kind of funding that enables the EPA to study these chemicals. For each chemical that is a priority chemical that we need to know something about before it gets on our market, mm-hmm. and as we are exposed to it and our children are exposed to it, or it degrades our environment and jeopardizes our health and welfare, each chemical that's reviewed and studied takes about $2 to $3 million.
Yeah.
In this bill, they've only offered $15 million. And we have 1,000 priority chemicals. And an industry in their pocket is about $40 billion a year. Yet they can't even supply enough funds to the EPA, which is an agency that's overburdened, mm-hmm. understaffed,
underfinanced.
And let's be honest, they're broke.
Yeah.
So how is it that this is a fair bill?
That raises my next question, which is, I know what activists and advocates outside of Washington or outside of the body politic like yourself and others are doing. What's the Obama administration, the EPA, how are they fighting back? How do they push back on this?
It's very difficult. Yeah. I think that should this bill pass, that the president, I would hope, would have some veto power mm-hmm. without sitting here talking like I know everything politically, mm-hmm. because that's a really hard thing to figure out. Mm-hmm. I've gone up on that hill and I'm like, well, I don't know how they get anything done up here. I'm sorry. But the EPA, their hands are really tied. And that's why it's even that more important that we can't preempt states' rights and states' attorneys general's ability to respond, because the federal government and the EPA right now are really inactive and doing nothing. I sat there at the hearings and I heard the EPA respond that it would not be good to preempt the state rights because they do need that help. This is an agency that really can't act. And so it's going to create a worse problem.
Well, that's how you know something sinister is going on. This isn't rocket science. This is a party, Republican Party, that is always for states' rights. Everything is about giving more power to the states.
Correct.
And when they want to preempt states and tie states' hands, there's obviously somebody lurking in the corners mm-hmm. who benefits from whatever this legislation is that mm-hmm. they want to get passed. I'm curious to get your take, which is what you make of the pushback that you see on Capitol Hill all the time and the work that you do. The pushback against the science that's telling us A, B, and C, mm-hmm. but the politicians say X, Y, and Z. They don't want to.
They don't. And, you know, the science does frustrate me.
Yeah.
And we set standards based on, most oftentimes, it's laboratory mm-hmm. studies. And what's frustrating me is the population, and I've started doing a mapping project mm-hmm. myself to take a look at where we might be missing disease clusters and what the American people are really experiencing. I have 15,000 individual communities across the United States reporting to me right now who live on and near Superfund sites, mm-hmm. who have been exposed to chemicals over a long period of time and have a disease process going on. And there's large numbers of them. Why science won't even allow to step back and go, okay, you know, one death is too many, but when you have a million of them reporting it, mm-hmm. where does that not become science, that you take a look that there's something wrong? So there's dose response ratios, the science is very slow, it takes many, many years to expose these chemicals, they're out in the market, we're digesting them, we're living on top of them, we're drinking them, we have cancer numbers on the rise, more and more children with ADD, and science has shown to some degree that could be associated with all these chemicals. We continue to have this argument. It does nothing but stall the process. And we really have to begin to take a look at what is going to be our priorities in this country. And it has got to be clean water. You know as well as I do, we're losing our water, a better environment, so we have a healthier population. We are sitting on an impending health crisis that's worse than what we have now. If we don't get in here, become solution-driven, stop the fighting, the length of time it takes to study something has got to happen faster so we can have a healthier population.
Are you heartened at all by whatever fight back, I assume there is some, I hope there's some, whatever fight back you're seeing by the Democrats in the Senate on this particular bill?
Or have
they yet begun to fight?
I don't think they've yet begun to fight. Yeah. And I hope that they will come forward and fight. A lot of groups outside of Washington, D.C. are really fighting. I mean, we've already got over 500 groups and medical groups and nurses associations and unions saying this is a bad Tosca bill. Don't pass it. Kill it if you have to. But I'm disheartened because there's been 8 Democrats who have signed on to the Vitter bill. And in their haste to want to try to do something to show all of us that they're working together up on the Hill would be a horrible mistake 5 years down the road to realize we have now basically hogtied all the states and their ability to act. So I, instead of wanting to show all of us that you can come together, don't do it just for the sake of doing it to look good and not understand the bill and understand what you are about to do to the states and to the consumer. Because, see, we will have no rights at that point. So I'm disappointed in the 8 Democrats that signed on, and I hope the rest of them will gear up and get ready for a fight.
Now, you know, courtesy of Erin Brockovich, one of our nation's iconic social activists. Erin, good to see you again.
Hey, it's good to
Thanks
see you.
Thanks for your work. You're welcome here anytime.
You know what? Okay, I got 2 more subjects. I want to come back.
We'll do it again.
Okay, good.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Films such as 12 Years a Slave and Selma and TV programs like Empire and Fresh Off the Boat have some observers hailing a new era of diversity in Hollywood. But a new study shows that in most ways, Hollywood remains as dominated by white men as ever. Darnell Hunt is a professor of sociology and the director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA. The center recently released a report that details the vast underrepresentation of people of color in film and television. It's titled The 2015 Hollywood Diversity Report, Flipping the Script. Professor Hunt joins us now to break down the findings. Darnell, good to have you on this program.
Nice to be here.
Thank you for your work every year when you guys put this out and try to keep us on track in this town. I want to start with a quote that I know you've seen 1,000 times. I was on the road last week, and my phone started blowing up when I heard this comment. The TV editor of Deadline Hollywood, Nellie Andreeva, wrote an article recently about the casting of people of color. And I quote, "Instead of opening the field for actors of any race to compete for any role in a colorblind manner, there has been a significant number of parts designated as ethnic this year, making them off limits for Caucasian actors," close quote. And no sooner than she pushed the send button on that story, the social media went insane and gave her the business about that comment. What did you make of it when you saw it?
Well, you know, it was incredibly tone deaf. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of reminded me, as a sociologist, I couldn't help but see the parallels between kind of what happened in the 1970s and 1980s, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, all the gains from the civil rights movement of the 1960s, suddenly there was a white backlash, you know, cries of reverse discrimination, which essentially is what she was saying, you know. So it's very unfortunate that she would make a comment like that that really was, I guess, bereft of historical perspective, really. Mm-hmm. Because the reality of it is we're so far behind in terms of minority and women, their participation in the industry, that we'd have to have decades of this type of, I guess, progress to actually reach anything close to proportionate representation.
It's not just unfortunate, it's uninformed, it seems to me.
Yeah.
I mean, Is there any evidence, we're going to get into some of your numbers here in your report this year, is there any evidence, are there any numbers anywhere on which she could base that argument?
You know, it sounds completely like anecdote and hearsay. I mean, right. you know, what I suspect is happening is the networks and studios may be rightfully saying, finally, mm-hmm. that, look, we have an increasingly diverse audience. The evidence shows they want diverse content in front of the camera and behind the content. And so finally, they're letting folks know that, bring us diverse content. Mm-hmm. Now, I doubt seriously they're setting quotas or saying that, you know, we're mandating that this percent has to be this. That just sounds like a bunch of hearsay and anecdote to me.
Yep. Before I get to these numbers again, I have my own thoughts about this, but this is not my conversation. It's your conversation. What do you make of? And I'm not asking you to critique the show per se.
Sure, sure.
You know where I'm going with this.
I suspect I do.
What do you think of the, by any measure, phenomenal success ratings-wise? Again, I have my own critique of the show.
Yeah.
But ratings-wise, what do you make of the week-to-week-to-week success of Empire? And it's not just a question about what you make of the success of that show, but what I really want to get to is, you can probably already figure out, is what the impact of that is going to be in this town. Will there now be other networks that finally want to cast a bunch of black folk in shows? I mean, what do you make of the success, and what do you think the impact of it will be, if any?
Yeah, well, I think it is going to have an impact. Mm-hmm. And it's not the first time. I mean, The Cosby Show made a huge impact when it debuted in 1984. You know, there weren't any blacks at all on TV, and suddenly it became like the top show on TV, mm-hmm. and everyone tried to copy it. Mm-hmm. Now, they did a poor job of copying it. Mm-hmm. Most of the shows didn't have the talent behind the screen or in front of the camera that The Cosby Show had, so a lot of them failed. Empire, I think, is kind of a perfect storm, really. I mean, you have all these elements to kind of come together to make it incredibly popular. Mm-hmm. You have hip-hop music, which kind of, you know, of course, you know, excites the current generation. You have the soap opera genre that older generations can relate to. In fact, I think that the ratings will show that across the board, you know, younger generations, older generations, everyone's watching Empire, and not mm-hmm. just African Americans. You also have kind of like, I don't know, like, you know, Dynasty or Dallas, you know, set to hip hop music. Mm-hmm. And so you have the musical element, you know, original music with Timbaland, you know, just all these elements. You have Oscar nominated actors, you know, mm-hmm. in front of the camera. You have Lee Daniels behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of ingredients we typically don't see in TV. And because of that, I think they have this smash hit on their hands that I don't think anyone really anticipated.
What happens, though, if Hollywood tries to copy and emulate Empire, which they certainly will do. When something makes money, everybody wants some of that.
Yeah.
So what happens when Hollywood emulates that, if one believes that that show showcases some of the worst pathologies in black America?
Right.
And there aren't enough socially redemptive characters, if one were to believe that there aren't enough socially redemptive characters in the series. When you mentioned Dynasty and Dallas, on both of those shows, there were good characters.
You know,
you got a crew here on Empire where, again, so many of our pathologies are on screen here every week. If that show starts to be emulated, will we black folk be complaining a couple of years from now that all the shows on TV about us show us in our worst, most pathological light?
Well, you know, I was actually on a program with Dr. Boyce Watkins last week, who's been a very vocal critic of Empire, and I actually disagree with him. I mean, I think the show is a little bit more complex than that. I think the characters show a certain humanity that we typically don't see when we're just dealing with stereotype, which tends to flatten down a character to like one or two characteristics and deny their humanity. I don't think we have that. You know, we have a range of different themes in the show that we don't typically deal with on TV, like homophobia in the black community. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that that particular character is probably one of the more redeemable characters on the show.
The only one, maybe.
Yeah. Well
at
maybe,
the moment.
Maybe not,
who else?
And then you have the Ivy League educated son. He has a mental health issue.
Yeah. But scheming to take over the company.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the genre. I mean, you know, melodrama, soap opera. I mean, if you think about the characters on Dynasty and Dallas, none of them were perfect. They all had their flaws. They were all scheming to take over something. That's what it was about, and that's the genre. So, you know, for me, it's about balance. I mean, if you can have a range of characters, if you can show different levels of accomplishment, and clearly these people are accomplished, regardless of how they got there. I mean, you could talk about the Kennedys in that respect.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, it's not your typical black show that traffics in stereotypes. I think it's a little different than that.
I think what concerns me is I take your point, Darnell, and I agree. It's about balance. But for me, it's about, for where black folk are concerned, fair or unfair, it's about interbalance and intrabalance.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean the show ought to have a balance of characters. but in the world of television writ large.
Absolutely.
If this becomes the standard fare, there clearly is no balance writ large.
Well I think you're exactly right. Yeah. And this is one of the reasons why we need more diversity behind the camera, not just in front of the camera, for the people who are making decisions, who are green lighting, who are taking pitch ideas. Because we don't want to have, you know, a TV universe filled with empires. I think one empire is enough.
Yeah.
We need to move on and do other types of shows, too, that also show the good and bad of black experience. I mean, the reality of it is we have some difficult issues we're dealing with. And as long as we don't, you know, kind of focus only on those issues to the exclusion of the positive things that are happening in our community, I think that we have a more realistic and humanistic treatment of black life and culture.
Couldn't agree more. In the time that I have with this report, which has got a lot of good stuff in it, I want to cover three categories. 2015 diversity, how women are doing, how minorities, people of color are doing, and how the executive ranks are faring. We can start wherever you want to start, but I want to cover all three of them.
Yeah, well, one thing I want to kind of point out, our report is retrospective because it contains so much data. We have like, you know, 100,000 cells in our data set, if you can imagine that, because we're looking at over 1,000 TV shows and maybe 100 variables for each show. So right now, you know, this report, the 2015 report, actually looks at the 2012-13 TV season. So we're about a year and a half behind.
Sure.
You know, we have to wait for the season to end before we can even start.
Fair enough.
However, for the executive suites, we did look at current data, and the picture is pretty abysmal. And it hasn't changed a lot over the last couple decades. I mean, if you look at TV, if you look at the very top in terms of the studio heads, we're talking about 93%, 94% white, and maybe about 70 to 75% male, all right? If you move down a level to the senior management group, again, we're talking 90-something percent white and maybe about, you know, 80% male. Down another level, if you look at unit heads, it opens up a little bit, maybe about 86% white and about 55% male. But again, a vast world controlled by white men, making all these decisions about what should be on the air, who should be behind it, based on their experiences, their preferences, which often excludes minority ideas and minority talent from sort of decision-making positions. In film, it's even worse. You know, so we're talking about a world where people of color have very little control over what gets made.
So what does the report say this year about the trend lines for women specifically?
Yeah, well, you know, the last report, and our 2015 report is the second in the series. The one we released last year looked at the 2011 season in film and 2011-12 in TV. And what we found was incremental increase on most fronts. You know, after all, 2013, as many people called it, was the year of breakout black film. So you had 12 Years a Slave, Fruitvale Station, et cetera. So it was kind of an aberrant year in many respects, given that there were quite a number of black directors, which of course led to casts that were more diverse. And so those numbers were picked up in our data. So underrepresentation by a factor of about maybe, I don't know, 2 to 1 among film leads in 2012-13. Compared to about maybe 3 to 1 the previous year. So a little bit of increase. So, you know, over time we'll be tracking this stuff to see whether or not it was just an outlier year or whether we're actually seeing the beginning of a new trend.
And people of color writ large?
Writ large, people of color are underrepresented on every front, you know, in front of the camera, behind the camera. The only question is how severe the underrepresentation.
Is it getting better, worse?
It's getting a little better, and I guess you could say over the long haul it has gotten better. I mean, 2015 is not 1950. However, the problem is...
What are you comparing it to?
Right, but the problem is America also is getting more diverse. I mean, America is almost 40% minority now. In a couple of decades, we're going to be majority minority. And guess what? Hollywood is not keeping up. So the gap in many respects is getting bigger between where America is and where Hollywood is.
You got 30 seconds left. How seriously does the industry take this report when you put it out?
You know, we have a number of supporters in the industry who, you know, say they want to do the right thing. We know that they're actually reading the report. They're talking about it. Everywhere we go, people are saying, oh, yeah, we're reading your report. Some of them are asking us to break down their internal numbers and to compare them to the industry as a whole. So I think they realize, you know, our study is showing that diversity sells, that TV shows that reflect the American population on average have the highest ratings, films that reflect the population have the highest box office. And so they're trying to figure out, how do we do this? How do we give the audience what it wants? The problem is there are a lot of white men entrenched in these powerful positions who don't want to share that privilege.
Can the public see this report or these parts of it?
Absolutely. Go to the website, you know, our website, the Bunch Center's website, or you can just Google us, 2015 Hollywood Diversity Report, Ralph J. Bunch Center for African American Studies, UCLA. It'll pop up.
There you go. Thanks for your good work, man.
Thank you.
Good
appreciate
to have
it.
You on, Darnell.
All right.
We'll be right back.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On April 9, 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to the Union Army of Ulysses S. Grant, ending the war that had the highest death toll of any in our nation's history. Joining me now are three historians to discuss the causes and the lasting consequences of that four-year American conflict. Pleased to welcome Dinah Ramey Berry, Associate Professor of History and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, Eric Walther, Professor of U.S. History at the University of Houston, and Allison Hobbs, Assistant Professor of American History at Stanford University. Honored to have you all on the program.
Thank you.
150 years later. I want to start our conversation with a quote that I wrote down. I have read countless times, I guess, in my life, Howard Zinn's wonderful book, A People's History of the United States. I'm sure you have all read that. Mm-hmm. There's a quote that Zinn has in this book. I suspect there'll be those who will disagree with it, but it's a great place, I think, to start our chat. This is from Howard Zinn's book. John Brown was executed by the state of Virginia with the approval of the national government. It was the national government which sternly enforced the laws providing for the return of fugitives to slavery. It was the national government that collaborated with the South to keep abolitionist literature out of the mails in the southern states. It was the Supreme Court of the United States that declared that the slave Dred Scott could not sue for his freedom because he was not a person but property. Such a national government would never accept an end to slavery by rebellion. It would end slavery only under conditions controlled by whites and only when required by the political and economic needs of the business elite of the North. It was Abraham Lincoln who combined perfectly the needs of business, the political ambition of the new Republican Party, and the rhetoric of humanitarianism. That's what Zinn had to say about the Civil War 150 years ago, which leads me to start our conversation, Professor Hobbs, by asking whether or not the Civil War, to your mind, was fought over the ethics of slavery, as we've all been taught in school, whether or not this was really about economics, not ethics, but economics. Mm-hmm.
It's a great question. I mean, the quote is really a fascinating quote. Mm-hmm. And just to say a couple things about the quote, it's what I find so interesting about it is the way that Zinn is explaining to us the role of the national government mm-hmm. and how the national government is playing such a major, a critical role in supporting slavery and in protecting slave owners' property. Mm-hmm. Because regardless, we know that enslaved people were human beings, mm-hmm. but of course, to Southern slaveholders, they were billions and billions of dollars of property. And so when the Civil War came, this was an incredible threat to a whole way of life, mm-hmm. To millions of dollars. A lot of historians have argued that Southerners didn't invest in other forms of infrastructure like railroads or like manufacturing because they had so much money tied up mm-hmm. in slavery. So I think that I would say that it's both, mm-hmm. that it's both about economics, but I think that the morality and the issue around slavery and slavery as a system mm-hmm. of human chattel cannot be ignored, and that we've spent a lot of time sort of looking away from right. the issue of slavery because we are so kind of scared to talk about mm-hmm. race and to really face those issues around slavery and race, but it seems like to really get a broader understanding of why the Civil War was actually fought, we really need yeah. to bring the issue of slavery into the conversation.
Professor Berry, ethics, economics, neither or both?
Well, I would argue it's a combination of all because mm-hmm. slavery is an economic institution. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when people don't want to deal with slavery, they'll say it was economics, but the primary institution that the Southern economy was based upon was slavery. When you look at the numbers, when we look at the actual dollar values, in 1805, there were about 1 million enslaved people in the United States, worth $300 million in mm-hmm. their value. And on the eve of the Civil War, about 50 years later, it was about 4 million African Americans that were enslaved, worth $3 billion. That's a mm-hmm. lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that's a large growth over time, so there are economics involved in this, but the economy was the body of enslaved people.
Yeah. And just to build on yeah. that point, the fact that by the eve of the Civil War, that slavery accounted for 70% mm-hmm. of the United States GDP.
Right.
So it really gives us a sense yeah. of just how, what a large percentage it accounted for.
Professor Walther, I wonder what your take is 150 years later on Abraham Lincoln, where this particular anniversary is concerned. there are any number of narratives that one could write about the role that Lincoln played or didn't play, what he did do, what he didn't do. He started out on the wrong side of the slavery question, took him a while to get on the right side. Mm-hmm. So what's your sense of, what's your Lincoln narrative 150 years later?
I find him quite admirable. Mm-hmm. Because, and I guess it goes hand in hand with being a college teacher and wanting to see people improve, mm-hmm. he improved. Mm-hmm. He knew he was a racist. He admitted it freely. I mean, not bragging about it. Mm-hmm. He admitted it and was a racist, did not believe that black people were white people's equal on the eve of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. But various events changed him, the war itself. Matter of fact, if you'll allow me to quote, I came across a quotation that fits so many occasions, but definitely pertains to Abraham Lincoln, mm-hmm. and that is, "We come to know who we really are in the darkest and most difficult days of our lives." Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, I was Tavis Smiley on The Daily Show September 11th last year.
I remember
but,
that.
But, yeah, but that is right, and Lincoln grew and probably came really close to completely purging his mind and heart and soul about racism.
And one could argue, I think legitimately, that as much progress as has been made 150 years later, these are still dark and desolate, right. dreary days. I say that because 150 years later, when you're still fighting about citizenship mm-hmm. and about rights exactly. and about democracy, mm-hmm. what does that say about where we are 150 years later?
We have not been free as long as we were enslaved. African Americans have mm-hmm. not been free as long as we've been enslaved. And so when you think about that on a temporal perspective, mm-hmm. it makes sense that we're still struggling and trying to find ways to interact with all groups of people. Mm-hmm. You have slavery lasting about 246 years, depending on when you date it. Mm-hmm. And then you look at how long we've been free. We've been free since 1865. And the Reconstruction era was short-lived. We tried to find ways as a country to heal ourselves from slavery, but there was 700,000 lives lost in this war. Parts of the South were completely devastated or destroyed, and you had a complete economic destruction of the South. So you have to rebuild from there, and the race relations were very tight after that. You have tensions that kept going even until today when we look at some of the Black Lives Matter movement. So I would argue we're still trying to figure it out. We're mm-hmm. a nation that has not really liked to talk about race, mm-hmm. and we're now at a point where we talk about it when we have to.
Professor Hobbs, I wonder your sense of the argument that we hear all the time, certainly mm-hmm. after America, we hear all the time, that when it comes to race, we ought to just get over it, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that in preparation for our conversation because, to your point, Professor Berry, we have not been free mm-hmm. as long as we were enslaved, number mm-hmm. one. Number two, the last soldier to die who fought in the Civil War just died right. in 1959. Jesus. And further, we're just now celebrating 50 years since the Civil Rights Act and 50 years since the Voting Rights Act. I am 50 years old.
Right.
And we're just now celebrating 50 years since the Voting Rights Act, basically 50 years since the Civil Rights Act. And I wonder whether or not people don't really have a proper
absolutely.
Perspective
absolutely.
On how near to slavery we still
absolutely.
Are.
That's absolutely right. I think that, one, there is a kind of disconnection that people have with our history mm-hmm. generally. And I really was moved watching 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. And in the very beginning, there's a scene where Solomon Northrop is on a boat and there's a man who's sitting next to him who's also enslaved. Mm-hmm. And there's a horrible act of violence that occurs where another enslaved person is stabbed brutally. And Solomon Northrop kind of jumps, and the man sitting next to him says, "You have to look away. That's the only way you can survive. You have to look away." And it seems like throughout that film, there are these reminders of, in order to be able to survive this, you have to look away. You can't look at it straight on because it's too devastating. It's too traumatizing. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like that's the way that Americans have been socialized to think and to understand or not to understand issues of race, that we look away, we turn away, and that seems to even widen this distance, or that seems to kind of create even more distance between us and our history, mm-hmm. that it is so much closer and it's so much more connected to our present day than I think a lot of people yeah. realize. So for example, you know, the 14th Amendment passed in 1868, mm-hmm. which along with the Civil Rights Act of 1866, was what codified birthright citizenship. So meaning if you're born in the United States, you are a citizen. I don't know if that could pass today. And that's really terrifying to think about, that if we think about these current issues that our country is going through when it comes to immigration, that perhaps we couldn't even pass a law today that we passed in 1868.
Yeah.
So I feel like that history is much closer to us than we know,
yeah.
And I feel like it's much closer to us than we want to see.
First of all, as you teach this stuff every day, what misconceptions, I know there are many, but is there a particular misconception about this anniversary 150 years later that most concerns you, that you tell your students all the time, if there's one thing that I need to set the record straight about, it's this?
In a nutshell, it was all about slavery.
Right.
Not in the economics of it. Also, for white Southerners, it was their sense of esteem and honor was to be literally the master class, the ruling race, as Jim Oakes wrote about many decades ago. And again, that you go from the horrors of slavery from 1619 to 1865, you go through the terror of Reconstruction that really was, on to lynching later in the 19th and early 20th century, and on and on and on and on. And I remember, well, right after the Supreme Court last year gutted the Voting Rights Act, I don't remember who the guest was on MSNBC, but it was a young African-American man, and he was just looking at the person who was doing the interview, and all he could say was like, it's been 400 years, and just stopped like this. And that was it. It's like, how many more fights for all people are created equal, for the Constitution, for Southern conservatism and rule of law. It's I can't really imagine that.
What lie most grates on you, Professor Berry?
That Lincoln's the great emancipator. I'm probably the outlier on this panel here, because my students feel like Lincoln freed all African Americans, and so I have to clarify that the 1863 Emancipation Proclamation freed slaves in the state of rebellion. Those were those in the Confederacy, but those that lived in those states did not believe Lincoln was their president. So there was this notion of Lincoln as being this great liberator. African Americans in the 1930s and 40s, when they were interviewed as the last living descendants of former slaves, they had photographs of Lincoln on their wall. That's an attitude about Lincoln that's prevailed, I would say. So I talked to the students about the nuances, about how he's changed over time, and about how he's not the sole person that liberated African Americans, and that African Americans fought for liberation from the moment they were captured at every single stage of enslavement, and even beyond in freedom.
Which was another issue I want to come back to after you get a chance to sound off of the thing that most disturbs you. I want to come back to this notion of self-liberation and the role that black folk themselves have played, not like somebody was just being nice. But we'll come back to that. But what most disturbs you?
That would be, would absolutely, I would definitely agree with that. That what I try to teach my students is that African American history is, of course, deeply a part of American history, and that the African American freedom struggle is so much longer and so much wider and deeper than I think we sort of understand. That we often think about these moments, and we don't sort of see this longer struggle. We don't see the idea that in the Middle Passage there were acts of resistance and rebellion, that then those acts of resistance and rebellion continued in small towns and on plantations and on farms, and then it was really the slaves that freed themselves by running to the Union Army and by creating the conditions that forced the federal government to have to take measures to eventually pass, or to eventually write the Emancipation Proclamation, for Lincoln to eventually write the Emancipation Proclamation. And then that during Reconstruction and during all these other turning points that we think about in American history, that there's always some resistance that's going on among African Americans. To think about the Great Migration as a part of the freedom struggle. So the freedom struggle is not, of course, the Civil Rights Revolution is an incredible watershed moment, but to sort of look at it in the context of this much longer history of rebellion and revolution.
How do we think of the period of Reconstruction that followed all
too
these
short.
Years later?
It was too short.
You
can't heal a nation that quickly. You also have the Freedmen Bureau workers coming into the South trying to help negotiate labor contracts, and whites that did not want to pay blacks for their labor, not willing to deal with the social situation. situation that was the result in the aftermath of the Civil War. So I would say that it was short-lived, and it was in a being blunt, it was unsuccessful.
I think Reconstruction for me is an incredibly rich period to teach. Mm-hmm. And I think it actually goes back to your previous question, that it's another moment that is also very misunderstood, mm-hmm. and sort of undertaught. And I think that the key, one of the really fascinating pieces about Reconstruction is that it's this moment of incredible hopefulness, mm-hmm. and incredible optimism. There's this sense that who knows what could happen? This is a new world. There's been a revolution. You know, people change their names. They change their names to things like Deliverance Begin, and, mm-hmm. you know, they change their last names to Freedman. And, mm-hmm. you know, so it's this moment of incredible expectation and anticipation. And I completely agree that the tragedy of it is that it's short-lived, that it turns into, well, actually, it begins with just explosive violence, which mm-hmm. continues throughout the period. The federal government does not do enough to protect former slaves and freed people. But also, I think the real problem is that the federal government doesn't offer land. Mm-hmm. That if freed people had land, that could have really changed everything. And there's a quote that I would love to read. Sure. It's very brief, but it's a freedman named Bailey Watts, and he's at a political meeting, which would then turn into the Union League mm-hmm. meetings that occurred throughout the South during Reconstruction. And he's in Yorktown, Virginia, and he speaks very powerfully about economics, but also about land and about the relationship between land and freedom. And he says, "May I state to all of our friends and our enemies that we has a right to the land where we are located. Why? I'll tell you. Our wives, our children, our husbands has been sold over and over again to purchase the lands we now locates upon. For that reason, we have a divine right to the land. And then didn't we clear the lands and raise the crops of corn and of cotton and of tobacco and of rice and of sugar and of everything? And then didn't them large cities in the north grow up on the cotton and the sugars and the rice that we made? I see that they have grown rich, yet my people are poor." Mm-hmm. So this really beautifully poignant, powerful message from a man who likely had not had formal schooling, had not taken an economics class, had not taken a political philosophy class, but yet understands these very complicated mm-hmm. concepts about the labor theory of value and about the necessity of land. And without land, could African Americans truly be free?
Mm-hmm. That's a powerful quote. I want to ask a question that is unapologetically loaded, but I'm curious as to what might come from this question, and that is, any parallels you would draw between the politics of then and the politics you see being practiced mm-hmm. in Washington today? I don't want to color the question any more than that deliberately.
So, for me, I think about Congress and yeah. about some of the issues that President Obama has had with getting Congress to move on topics that he was trying to get them to move on. Mm-hmm. You see some of those challenges with Lincoln and even within the Emancipation Proclamation and even dealing with the issues of colonization. Mm-hmm. So, I think that Congress can sort of tie things up, and we're seeing some of those same tactics today.
Yeah. Well, and actually, during the Civil War, one of the many obstacles Lincoln had that his adversaries didn't really have to deal with mm-hmm. was a vigorous two-party system in the North during the Civil mm-hmm. War. Mm-hmm. You had politicians demanding and getting generals named by their political party. Mm-hmm. I mean, George McClellan was thrust on Lincoln. That was not Lincoln's choice, mm-hmm. but he knew he had to stick with McClellan to keep the Democratic Unionists.
Professor Hobbs, any parallels you draw between the politics then and the politics we see being practiced today?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that one thing that I wish we had more of today is that Lincoln, I think, I agree that he evolved, and I agree that there was this sort of transformation in his thinking. But I also think that part of what happened was that he had a lot of people really putting a lot of pressure on him.
Oh, yeah.
He had abolitionists. You know, he had William Lloyd Garrison, who immediately says, you know, you're not doing enough. You've got to go farther. This isn't strong enough. Even the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, it's not strong enough. We have to move farther. He also had a number of senators and congressmen, like, you know, someone like Salmon Chase, someone mm-hmm. like Trumbull. So there really was a lot of pressure and a lot of sort of support that Lincoln had to kind of push him farther. And I sort of wish that we were moving further mm-hmm. to the left today, yeah. you know, and that there was more pressure to push us further to the left.
I'll start with you, Professor Berry. If there is a particular takeaway that the American people ought to focus on 150 years later, what do you want us to consider?
I think we need to talk about race. We need to talk about slavery.
Still.
Yes, yeah. I do. I don't think we're done. Mm-hmm. I think we need to understand the ramifications of slavery and the wealth that was generated from slavery mm-hmm. and what that means and why there's such a large economic disparity today. Yeah. I think that's the main takeaway for me. But I'm a scholar of slavery, so yeah. I'm going to say that.
No, I accept that.
Yeah.
Professor Walther?
That slavery still matters, that the Civil War still matters, that, as you said at the beginning, this far, you take all of the battle death from the American Revolution, War of 1812, Mexican War, Indian Wars of the 19th century, on and on and on, right through World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and it's still a little bit under all of the deaths from the Civil War combined.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we've actually just broken through that by a few thousand over in just recently, within the last few years. And that matters. The scars from that are still there. From the Reconstruction era, we have a lot of these, a lot of southern states and other Midwestern states just kind of ignoring the Constitution, yeah. not kind of, literally doing it, challenging Supreme Court decisions right now. Mm-hmm. The controversy in Indiana, it's about yeah. bigotry.
Professor Hobbs, take away for you.
Just very quickly, I would say that I think that it's very important for us to know our history mm-hmm. and that history allows us to understand our past, it allows us to understand our present, and it also allows us to imagine a different kind of future. And I think that in those dark hours, that history for me becomes very kind of healing in a mm-hmm. sense, because I see the possibility of something different. And that's why I think the Reconstruction era, while it didn't go far enough and it didn't last long enough, it still offers us this sense of the possibility of something different. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would say that I think that we need to know our history, and we need to sort of immerse ourselves in our history so that we can see that history is not linear, that mm-hmm. that it's never a story of, you know, slavery to freedom, slavery to Obama, mm-hmm. that there are always these fits and starts. There are always these moments of devastation, and then there are these moments of hopefulness and optimism. Mm-hmm. And I think that can sort of keep our spirits kind of buoyed when we do face these moments that are difficult and
so
challenging.
Wonderful conversation, never long enough, but thank you all for coming on and expressing your insights 150 years after the end of the Civil War. Dinah Ramey Berry, Associate Professor of History and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, Eric Walther, Professor of U.S. History at the University of Houston, and Allison Hobbs, Assistant Professor of American History at Stanford. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is TRI. Keep the faith.